It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Farad. Wisconsin is one of 24 states where attorneys general are claiming President Donald Trump's executive order banning birthright citizenship is unlawful.
Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments on whether that executive order is unconstitutional.
On his first day in office last year, Trump signed an order declaring that children born on American soil but to non-citizen parents or a mother who is unlawfully present in the country would not receive citizenship immediately.
The order has now reached the Supreme Court after every lower court declared it illegal and blocked it from going into effect. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call joins us to respond to yesterday's arguments. Welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
So the U.S. Supreme Court justices heard oral arguments just over 2 hours in Trump versus Barbara. What stood out to you about yesterday's proceedings?
Well, I think as you know, we've made clear throughout this case, there's a very strong argument that the Trump administration's executive order is unconstitutional, and I'm very confident still that it's going to be struck down. A lot of justices were skeptical of this, and for very good reason, because what the Trump administration did here just flouts precedent. It flouts the language of the Constitution, and it would fundamentally change what it means to be an American in a way that would ultimately result in citizenship not being given to kids who otherwise would receive it in this country.
The administration is arguing also that the 14th Amendment has been misinterpreted and that they say the phrase subject to the jurisdiction of the U.S. means that it requires more than just a child's parents being on U.S. soil to be granted citizenship. What do you make of that reasoning?
Well, first, let's start with the language of the 14th Amendment. It says that all persons born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. Now, as you said, they're trying to argue that certain kids who are born in the U.S. aren't subject to the jurisdiction thereof, but that just misunderstands what that phrase means. If you were born here with some very limited exceptions, you are subject to the laws of this country. People who commit crimes here, for example, can be prosecuted here. If you are somebody who has diplomatic immunity, you would not be subject to the jurisdiction. That would be the kind of exception we're talking about. But for over 100 years, this has been understood to mean that people who are born here and subject to our laws are citizens. That's what the Constitution says. It's what the history of this amendment supports. And I'm confident that the justices are going to reject the Trump administration's argument.
What would be the ramifications of a ban on birthright citizenship here in Wisconsin?
It would be extremely complicated. And one of the things that came up in the argument is it's not even clear how you administer the test that the Trump administration is proposing, because if, you know, what we have now is if you're a child born in the U.S., and again, you're not subject to these very limited exceptions, you receive citizenship. If the Trump administration approach were to be put in place, there would have to be some sort of assessment done to determine which kids are citizens and which ones aren't. That would be a very complex procedure. And again, it's not clear how that would work. The Solicitor General, the president's, the Department of Justice's representative in court, didn't have great answers on these topics. And so, you know, we would see a sea change in how citizenship is administered. Again, though, it seems like the Supreme Court is going to reject that argument.
So there's 24 states, including Wisconsin, in this, you know, multi-state coalition of attorneys general, you know, calling the birthright citizenship ban illegal. Would states like Wisconsin that object to it follow the order if the high court sides with President Trump?
Well, of course, we always follow the law in Wisconsin. And, you know, if the Supreme Court were to rule in President Trump's favor, we would then have to figure out how that executive order applied and you know, what its implications were for the state of Wisconsin. But again, you know, one of the things I think is important to note here is just what a challenge this is, not just to birthright citizenship, but to the very rule of law itself. This decision has stood for over 100 years. It's based on the plain language of the 14th Amendment. There's also federal law making clear that birthright citizenship is the law of the land. And despite all of that, the Trump administration tried to do something different. The fact that the Supreme Court even took this for argument and heard argument on it shows that Donald Trump has been able to exert his authority in a way that has caused courts to take up arguments that really aren't serious. And that's concerning when it comes to thinking about the rule of law and what it means right now. I'm glad that it's going to be rejected, but it's unfortunate that we've even gotten this far.
You sound very confident that the justices will reject this.
Yeah, well, there was clear skepticism expressed by the justices. Chief Justice Roberts, for example, at one point, made the point that while circumstances had changed, which is what the Solicitor General is arguing, the Constitution has not. Justice Barrett asked some questions that indicated some of the challenges that would be presented by the Trump administration's position. So I am very confident. This is not a topic that really was controversial until President Trump decided to make this a new issue. And so I'm hopeful that that we will see the rule of law upheld. And that's what the argument indicated. Again, you never know what the court will do until they issue their ruling. But again, I'm confident, as I have been throughout this process.
We're talking about the birthright citizenship case before the U.S. Supreme Court as justices. They heard oral arguments yesterday. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call is with us, Wisconsin being one of 24 states challenging President Trump's executive order. Attorney General, there's no official count of pregnant people who travel to the U.S. to give birth so that their baby can have American citizenship. But the U.S. Solicitor General, John Sauer, he argued yesterday before the justices that birth tourism is, quote, creating a whole generation of American citizens abroad with no meaningful ties to the U.S. Is birth tourism occurring in Wisconsin?
Well, as the Solicitor General said in the argument, we don't really know this. This is something that people have talked about. And, undoubtedly, there are cases where people have abused the system in any context, but he was not able to offer much in the way of concrete information when it comes to this topic. And if that is a concern, then that's something that the administration could try to focus on in a variety of ways. But the idea that you're going to fundamentally overhaul birthright citizenship, and that's the way we're going to address this topic, is to cause many, many more problems than the administration would even be trying to solve.
So birth tourism isn't an issue to you?
Well, like I said, the Trump administration wasn't able to provide concrete information on this topic. And so, if that's a topic people want to look into further and explore ways to address, that's a separate question from fundamentally whether you change birthright citizenship, which should have implications for kids born in this country in all sorts of cases.
For parents in Wisconsin who are worried about their children's legal status right now, what is their legal reality today?
Well, kids who have been granted their citizenship in the U.S. are going to keep their citizenship regardless of what happens in this case. What this would potentially impact is kids who are born in the future. For people who may have children down the road, this could have an impact on them, depending on whether they fell within the within what the president's executive order addresses. What I can tell people is, I and every other Democratic AG in the country have been fighting against this Trump administration executive order. We are committed to upholding the language of our Constitution and defending the rule of law, and that's what we've done throughout this case. As I've said from the beginning in this case, I'm confident we are going to win this. I think it's important to note that we have a very conservative U.S. Supreme Court. And even in that court, Donald Trump's arguments were met with overwhelming skepticism at the argument yesterday. And so I remain confident that that birthright citizenship will remain the law of the land. And, it is the plain language of our Constitution. If we can't even uphold that language, that's a real threat to the rule of law, but I'm confident that we will.
One other topic I want to get to here is that the executive order President Trump this week issued calling for lists of eligible voters to be created at the state level and curtailing mail-in voting. What is your response to this action?
Well, what he's done here, it tramples on the Constitution. It is clearly an attack on access to voting, and it's an attack on our democracy. It goes beyond just creating lists. It would, for example, do things like prevent the Postal Service from delivering ballots to people who are not identified by the administration as being appropriate recipients. Presumably, they would try to do this for the midterms, but whatever list they created is sure to have massive errors on it. That would have major consequences for voters. So I'm very confident here, just like I was with birthright citizenship, that this is going to be blocked. And I'm confident that this new executive order is not going to impact ultimately the ability of Wisconsin to continue having free and fair elections, because I believe key aspects of this executive order are going to be blocked. But this is the president trying to assert control over elections, which are traditionally run by the states. Congress is the body that has the power to take action if there is a concern. Again, this is the president acting on his own. So this should trouble folks who care about the rule of law and our Constitution.
Just one thing you said there. Why would lists of eligible voters have massive errors?
Well, this administration is completely incompetent, first of all. Now, on top of that, there is no single list out there of everybody who is eligible to vote. The people who keep those lists are the states who administer elections. I have no confidence whatsoever in this administration putting together some overall list that will identify everybody who's eligible to vote.
Attorney General Josh Call, thank you for your time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That is Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call, as we've been talking about the U.S. Supreme Court's hearing on birthright citizenship, how the ruling could affect Wisconsin residents, and also President Trump's executive order this week calling for lists of eligible voters to be created.
Up in Northeast Wisconsin, nonprofits serve people living in poverty. Get an update from housing advocates who are left scrambling as Green Bay-based NewCap abruptly closed its doors this week.
For Brown County, while they have some other resources, they did not have any other resources for people experiencing chronic homelessness.
That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A Northeast Wisconsin nonprofit that worked with people living in poverty for more than 60 years abruptly shut down this week.
The community action organization NewCap cited significant and ongoing financial challenges.
Also on Tuesday, Republican State Representative David Steffen of Howard sent a letter to the State Justice Department urging that it launch an investigation into NewCap alleging misuse of taxpayer dollars. Steffen told WPR,
"There's a lot of questions there, more than enough to open up an investigation to see if there was any criminal wrongdoing associated with this organization."
NewCap provided a wide range of services that included housing grants to over 130 families. Its closure leaves local housing advocates concerned about service gaps in the 10-county service area that included Green Bay.
Carrie Poser is executive director of the Wisconsin Balance of State Continuum of Care. It's a nonprofit that coordinates housing and supportive services for individuals and families experiencing homelessness across most of the state. We spoke yesterday. How widespread of an impact did NewCap have in the community and in the 10 counties it served?
A significant impact, given that they serve 10 counties, one of which is Brown, and the other nine being very rural, they played a tremendous role in that community, touching lots of different types of service delivery. Mine obviously falls into the folks experiencing homelessness category, but they also did a lot of other work around low-income households.
Can you speak to how big of an issue is homelessness and the need for housing services in this region of Wisconsin?
Oh, significant. Brown County has, I would say, the largest unsheltered and the largest sheltered population in need of housing and support in the balance of state. So out of the 69 counties I serve between Brown County and the Fox Cities, I believe it is close to a third of the homeless population, if not larger. And I can get you actual numbers on that, but it is a significant percentage of the folks. Given the lack of resources up in the northeastern 9-county area, losing any resource is detrimental to that community. For Brown County, while they have some other resources, they did not have any other resources for people experiencing chronic homelessness. That housing program, it is the only one that actually exists in the Green Bay area.
With the situation here, 134 families depending on these housing grants from NewCap. With NewCap closed, what kind of capacity do you see in the area for other organizations to step up and fill the gaps?
That's a great question. So we have been able to identify several organizations that can step in. What we run into, so capacity-wise, they're willing to do the work. They care about their community. They care about the humans that are being impacted and are willing to step up. And that's a tremendous shout out to the Brown County Coalition and the partner agencies that are willing to do that. What the problem is the funding is held up at this point by HUD and blocking our ability to transfer those funds to the hands of the people that could do the work. So if those agencies are able to do it, right now there's no funding to be able to support those efforts.
Okay, so let's unpack that. One of the big concerns here is for U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development grants, HUD grants, that NewCap administered. Give us a brief overview of what they fund.
Sure. So they had a variety of different ones that covered both those 9 rural counties and then some that were specific to Brown County. In the rural area, they have 50 households that are currently being served by NewCap. It's a little over $1.1 million. One of those grants was a rural outreach and supportive services for youth grant. One is a permanent supportive housing project for those experiencing chronic homelessness. There are 17 households currently in that project, and that project ended yesterday. They are a subgrantee of our agency for a domestic violence rapid rehousing grant. There are 33 households currently being served in that grant. I got confirmation this morning that my staff were able to get the client files from NewCap and are working on reaching out to those clients to make sure that April rent gets paid. In the Brown County area, there are 84 households currently being served by NewCap, one of which is a very large permanent supportive housing project for folks that are experiencing chronic homelessness. There are 61 households currently being served. Then there is a rapid rehousing for youth age 18 to 24, and there are currently 21 households being served in that project.
So you are trying to get these HUD grants transferred to these other agencies now. What is the status of that movement?
On March 27th, I submitted the paperwork for the transfer. So that generally involves a relinquishment letter from the agency that has the grant, so NewCap, the new agency, a letter agreeing to take on the transfer, and then a letter from the COC saying that we agree that this is a good fit. And that was all submitted to the HUD field office on Friday, March 27th. I got an email yesterday morning confirming that they had received those packages, they had received that information, and that is it. That is the only communication that I've had thus far from HUD about the need for these transfers.
We're talking about the sudden closing of the Green Bay nonprofit NewCap and its impact on homelessness and housing services in the Brown County area. We have Carrie Poser with us, executive director of the Wisconsin Balance of State Continuum of Care. It's a nonprofit that coordinates housing and other services for people experiencing homelessness. Carrie, what kind of communication have you had with Wisconsin's congressional delegation or other federal leaders about these grants?
Yeah, so just to take us back just a little bit, we found out on March 17th that the plan was that NewCap was going to close, that there wasn't an actual date in mind, but that was their intent. In my communication with them, we talked about the need for them to continue maintaining a couple of these grants because the end dates aren't till the end of the year, and they had access to the federal funding source, right? They could draw down funds in order to provide the service. So there was a plan for that. Once we found out that NUCAP was closing, that shifted gears, and emails went out actually last night to all federally elected officials, state officials, local officials, providers in Brown County and the other nine rural areas, Wisconsin DCF, Wisconsin DHS, Wisconsin DPI, along with my organization's board of directors and all key points of contact. So I feel like we flooded as much as we could, folks, asking them to get involved and to reach out to their federal congressional delegation.
So can you give us a sense of how these HUD grants compare in size to other federal housing grants Wisconsin receives?
Sure. In the balance of state, I can compare them to that, to what's in the balance of state. I'm not as familiar with the HUD grants that are received in Dane, Milwaukee, or Racine. Mm-hmm. The permanent supportive housing grant is for individuals is the largest single award that is in the balance of state. So we receive approximately $25 million. Our organization doesn't receive those $25 million. That is $25 million that comes into the organizations under the balance of state. I know it's kind of complicated, but mm-hmm. but basically it's a package of grants that gets submitted together as a whole. Mm-hmm. But that NUCAP grant is the largest single grant. NUCAP having 1, 2, 3, 4 of these HUD grants isn't completely unusual. We have some other CAP agencies that have a couple, 2, 3 grants that they operate. We have another organization in the southern part of Wisconsin, I think, that has 2 or 3 different kinds of grants, one for rapid rehousing, one for youth, mm-hmm. and one for permanent supportive housing, because each of those are different interventions for different groups of people. Given that NUCAP was covering such a large area, it isn't unusual that they would have different kinds of grants in those particular areas.
Some wraparound services that
Correct.
Would go with, you know, as part of a package of grants. So, Carrie, looking down the road here, if these grants cannot be transferred and are lost, how hard is it for another organization, another nonprofit, to apply for and receive some type of similar grant to replace them?
So it would be a $2.7 million loss, permanent loss, both to the 10 counties that NUCAP covers, along with the balance of state. So the total amount of our renewal demand, HUD uses math to then take that number and determine how much extra funding we could write for. Mm-hmm. Like we call it bonus dollars or new project money. So the less renewal demand we have, the less bonus funds we will ever be allowed to apply for in a future competition. In addition to that, it will negatively impact the amount of what we call the planning grant. That planning grant covers basically the cost of my staff to do the work to support the efforts for all the grants in the balance of state. So we're looking at a hit in that way, along with for the people in the 10 community or the 10 counties, the soonest they would be able to apply for funds would be in the next competition for grants that would start sometime in 2027. It will be in no way $2.7 million. The most it would be based on, I'm estimating with a loss, maybe we would have access to $400,000 to $500,000. And in the past, it has been a little bit difficult to get new projects put into communities when projects had been removed by HUD. Does that make sense? So yeah. It has been difficult to get new projects put in place when grants are lost.
Carrie, we really appreciate your update. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Carrie Poser is executive director of the Wisconsin Balance of State Continuum of Care. It's a nonprofit that works to end homelessness in the state. She was with us to share the potential impacts of the Green Bay nonprofit NewCap that announced this week it would be closing immediately. Now we're turning to another local nonprofit trying to step up and fill the gaps that will be created in the community. Elizabeth Feldhausen is executive director of Safe Haven Pet Sanctuary in Green Bay. She and her co-founder are working to open a new homeless shelter in the same location of the one that was formerly run by NewCap. Elizabeth, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You run an animal shelter. How did you get involved in starting to provide shelter for people as well?
Yeah, so I have Safe Haven Pet Sanctuary on Broadway in Green Bay. And we are around a lot of local parks where a lot of unhoused individuals hang out. And we had some very severe weather in February this year, where we were getting like negative 30, negative 40 for the feels like temperatures. And we found out that there were still people hanging out in those parks because they had nowhere to go. And with us having this big building that's already heated, that has bathrooms, has couches. I mean, Safe Haven is set up like a sanctuary, so it's not cages. It's mostly, you know, just set up like a big living room and the cats hang out with people. So we just thought we have this big heated space. Why can't these people come in and spend time with the cats? And so we began inviting people in during the severe weather. And as it continued and continued, we didn't want to have to ask anyone to go back out. So we kind of started to plan and see, you know, what could we do where we can find a safe place for these people to go? Because also along the way, they got to know the cats. They got to know how to work at Safe Haven. They became volunteers, and this emotional bond formed where people who had been previously unhoused due to maybe addiction or mental illness were finding therapeutic benefits through working with the animals. And they were doing things like asking for rides to detox and asking to go to drug and alcohol rehabilitation. And within the first couple of weeks, we had helped at least six people take the next step in their recovery journey or a health journey or mental health journey. And their reason for wanting to get better and kind of learn and grow was these cats. So we just found this beautiful relationship and, and thought, what an amazing thing. How can we keep going with this?
And to keep going with this, to present day, how did you get connected to NewCap and the availability of the shelter they were closing?
So I actually ended up linking up with Kathy Aredo, and she is a local woman who had been bringing blankets and hand warmers and food to all of these individuals in the parks for years. And she had been wanting to open up a shelter. So we linked up with all of our unhoused friends and neighbors and kind of collaboratively came up with a plan. When we came up with this plan, we began working with the city. And Will Peters at the city has been absolutely amazing. He actually made the connection for us. So he knew that there were, you know, things happening with NewCap and that they may need to offload one of their buildings. And that is when we sat down with NewCap and kind of discussed how could these resources still support the chronically unhoused.
What is the process like for transferring the building to you to take over the shelter? And then I'm wondering, will you run it with the animals as part of the shelter?
Yes. So we actually signed a lease on the 27th to rent the house from NewCap. But I believe it's going to be rented from the city if we are no longer renting it from NewCap. There were talks about just purchasing it from them, but for whatever reason, we had to do it this way. And I think it does have to do with the HUD grants and what the purpose of the building and the use of the building. But I'm not a good person to ask about those things. But the transfer, as far as I know right now, what we did was sign a lease. We turned in all of our policies and procedures to the city of Green Bay for them to review. And we're in the process of approval. So as of today, we are not living in that shelter yet. Mm-hmm. We don't have permission from the city. However, we are in the backyard, currently having a 3-day fire for one of our friends that has passed away in the last couple of days here. So,
sorry to hear that. So what is your vision for the Safe Haven Hope Center? What will it ultimately do?
So our vision for the Safe Haven Hope Center is a low barrier shelter for those who have been kicked out of the other shelters for one thing or the other, or maybe they are still using, or they have a severe mental illness. That's kind of where we come in, where we're doing almost like a Maslow's hierarchy of needs model, where we're making sure basic needs and safety are met first before we're asking too much of anyone, or asking for too much change too fast, and kind of helping people through programs as far as providing therapeutic support, on the job training, as they will still be helping and working with Safe Haven Pet Sanctuary and the cats, as well as fostering 7 cats in the home. So they'll be getting that experience as well to build resumes and get jobs. And so ultimately, this will be transitional living. It's also just a little bit slower than most transitional living. We're putting our term for up to 2 years because we know that sometimes safety takes time, and maybe a harm reduction model takes time for addiction. So we're slowing down transitional living a little bit, and we're adding animal care and on-the-job training.
Elizabeth, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Feldhausen is Executive Director of Safe Haven Pet Sanctuary in Green Bay. She was with us to share her efforts to open a new homeless shelter in one previously operated by NewCap. I also spoke yesterday with Carrie Poser, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Balance of State Continuum of Care.
Coming up, a photographer shares a new book of images from the Milwaukee music scene and his love of local music in the area.
I feel like every season that goes by, there are new artists and bands emerging that I've even never heard of. And it leaves me with the sense of there's still so much to explore here. There's so much to learn.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new book from a Milwaukee photographer documents live performances from nearly 24 musicians from or connected to the city, and it gives a glimpse into Milwaukee's live music scene.
Samer Ghani is an artist and photographer who began taking photos at small Milwaukee venues back in 2016.
After years of documenting live music and tens of thousands of photos, he's putting together a book sharing his love of the Milwaukee music landscape and highlighting some of his favorite music acts over the years, including Buffalo Nichols, who we're hearing now.
Samer Ghani's new book is called Memories of a Street Cat. Samer, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for this opportunity. This means the world to, you know, a working artist in Milwaukee.
Now, looking at the book, this feels like a labor of love. How did you get started photographing all these performances in the music scene in Milwaukee?
Thanks for categorizing it as a labor of love, because that's probably the best way I've heard it described. I spent so many years documenting live music in Milwaukee just because I thought it was a really important personal mission. I realized how talented some of these artists were. And I think the inspirational thought was, well, if I started documenting them at the highest degree that I could, maybe people would start to like take them a little more seriously and start investing in what they're doing. And it really snowballed from there.
What was your first connection with the Milwaukee music scene before maybe you thought about picking up the camera and taking pictures of these performers?
Sure. I grew up playing music. I went to MPS schools, and I spent time in orchestra in middle school, and that blossomed into me exploring different instruments as I went through high school, like guitar and bass guitar and drums. And as I got older, I was in and out of fun bands with my friends and other people that were around. But there's a gentleman I met named Andy Kosanke after I graduated high school, and he was in a practicing band that was playing live music in Milwaukee at the time named Paper Holland. And I started documenting his band first, just simply due to proximity and the fact that we were buddies and we were hanging out. And I met so many other artists through hanging around Paper Holland and meeting, going to different clubs and venues around the city.
I was going to ask you, you know, if Milwaukee's music scene gets enough love outside of Milwaukee, but maybe we should start a little earlier. Does Milwaukee's music scene get enough love inside Milwaukee, right? Do you feel like it's appreciated by the people in the city, or maybe it's this hidden gem that people, even locals, aren't attached to?
I really think it's a hidden gem. I think even for myself, spending so much time in the arts and culture community, I feel like every season that goes by, there are new artists and bands emerging that I've even never heard of. And it leaves me with the sense of there's still so much to explore here. There's so much to learn. There's so much happening. And as we continue to invest in our arts and culture community, and primarily our music and live entertainment community, not only will that have a great economic impact on our city, but it paves the way for younger, newer artists to continue to invest in themselves and in the arts and culture space at large.
All right, now to your photography. You started taking pictures. Obviously, looking at some of these pictures, the bands, many of these performers, they're on board with this. You're getting angles that, you know, I wouldn't get if I just showed up at a show. What started you actually working with the bands and I assume venues to say, hey, I'm not just doing this as a crowd member. I'm really documenting something here as a photographer.
You know, when I first started shooting artists back in 2016, I would pay my way to go to shows at Cactus Club, Cooperage. Well, Cooperage came a little bit later, but venues around the city I would pay to go into, because I realized at the time that I didn't really have a lot of trust built up with not only the artists, but the rest of the music community in Milwaukee at large. I thought it was really important to invest in that trust. So I would pay my way to go into shows and I would shoot. I would email the photos to the bands. Best case scenario, they would use them. Worst case scenario, they wouldn't. But after years of doing that, Kelsey from Cactus Club told me, you know, you don't have to always pay if you're going to be working these shows. Like, as long as you share them with us so that we can share them on socials and we get some value out of it, like, you're more than welcome to shoot here for free. And a light bulb kind of went off in my head. And I realized that I finally got to a place where I was providing value. I did build trust. I did affect some of the artists that I was working with in a positive way. It was really important for me to get to that point before I started asking the larger venues like the Pabst Theater Group and Summerfest if I could have the opportunity to shoot some of those larger shows too. Not only did I need the portfolio also, but it was really important to me that I did it the right way, that I wasn't overstepping any boundaries and that I was cutting my teeth, that I was learning the practice of art on the business side, as well as becoming a better shooter.
What does it take to take a good picture of a band in action? And I'll let you know, Samer, I'm a terrible photographer. And when people are moving, I'm even worse. You've captured some great moments, the national artists, local artists, and points in between. What does it take to find that magical moment that really brings the viewer into that performance?
That's a great question. It really takes a little bit of luck and a lot of patience. And when I shoot artists, I really, my scope becomes really narrow. I'm really focused in on how they're moving, how the song is changing. And I'm really focused on my internal intuition, anticipating something about to happen. I call it the hunt because it really feels almost primal in the way that I'm so laser focused on everything that's happening on stage, everything that's happening off stage. I'm paying attention to the light designer on some of those bigger venues and what they're doing to affect the performance. And in this moment to moment calculation that I'm running, I'm just staring at the artist like a quarterback stares at the football. Right? Like, it's such a uniquely activated artistic expression. And to get some of those shots, it does take a lot of reps. It takes a lot of time to understand your physical limitations. I'm a short guy, so it does. I need to understand my positioning around crowd people in the crowd. I need to understand my positioning to the relative height of the stage and how long the song's going to be. So a lot of stuff goes through my head when I'm shooting a show, and all those variables kind of bleed into the perfect show photo for that unique show.
Now, you've got in your book some nationally touring artists, Death Cab for Cutie, Brandi Carlile. They're probably pretty used to having pictures taken of them at this point. Working with those local bands who, you know, being in a local band doesn't always make you feel like a rock star. What was it like for them getting these quality shots and seeing them? And how did you approach that, working with these local bands?
You know, I just really believed in a lot of these guys. I went to so many shows over the years that so many artists left a real impact on me as a lover for music. And I just really wanted to represent them in their best light. And in the book, I had the opportunity to collaborate with Matt Wild of Milwaukee Record, and he interviewed some of the artists in the book, getting slices of their experience working with me. And that was such an enriching overlapping piece to add to the whole experience of Memories of a Street Cat.
Samer Aghani is with us talking about his new photo book, Memories of a Street Cat. Samer's a longtime artist and photographer born and raised in Milwaukee. The book is pictures, live stage photos, and portraits of bands, local and national. Let's talk about some of the local artists. Early on in the book, Samer, you've got Buffalo Nichols, the band, blues singer-songwriter Carl Nichols, longtime Milwaukee performer. I think he's moved on to Austin at this point. Talk a little bit about seeing them, work with them, photographing Carl and the band.
Carl is a dear friend of mine, and one of the first artists I started documenting early on in my journey alongside Paper Holland. A few other artists in that category are the artist Classic, as well as Sister Strings. And over the years, Carl and I really grown as artists together. And as he went on to do bigger national tours and things like NPR's Tiny Desk, when he has the opportunity, he'll often include me to shoot his music video promos for his latest album, or to actually tag along on tour with him. And because I invested so much into him and our friendship very early on in our journey, when he has the opportunity, he likes to bring me along still to reinvest back into me. And it's this wonderful, beautiful artistic friendship, and we continue to grow together as artists. So it was really important for me that he had a section in the book, and I'm really grateful that he's one of the first.
Your photos include your stage photos, as I mentioned, but also portraits. Wrangling band people, rock band people, I think in particular, makes herding cats look pretty easy. What's it like getting them to, cooperate and get into position and come out with good portraits?
You know, it takes a level of collaboration and a lot of creative problem solving. I think most artists, if they're listening, can attest to something always looks better in your head, right? And like, it's especially with photo and video, the raw reality of things is sometimes tough to deal with. But creatively problem solving with a lot of these artists, it's great. It's less like a hydra where I'm speaking to five heads at once, and it's more of a collaboration of ideas. And sometimes people will have ideas that I have never thought of. And it makes me feel really genuinely valued when I'm getting four or five, when I'm working with a band in particular, four or five different perspectives. It offers a level of collaboration that is unlike working with one other person. And it's really exciting. And I think some of my best work comes from that overlapping level of collaboration.
You mentioned the Cactus Club, and I understand you're working with the arts nonprofit arm of the Cactus Club. Can you tell us a little bit about the role this venue and this nonprofit has in the local music scene?
Absolutely. Cactus Club has been an institution of live music, and I think, broadly speaking, on the economic value that Cactus adds to the city of Milwaukee and arts entertainment is comparable to Pabst Theater Group, I think touring bands will graduate from Cactus Club and then go to Pabst Theater Group on their next time around if they grow as an artist, right? It's a really healthy thing for a market like Milwaukee to have. So Cactus has positioned themselves alongside venues like the Cooperage and X-Ray Arcade into being that liaison, making a destination for artists who are on their way up to stop here. And that has a great economic impact on Milwaukee's arts and culture scene. The nonprofit arm started as a reaction to COVID when bars and venues weren't getting as much business as they were. The owner, Kelsey Kaufman, thought, well, what if we started doing educational community-focused programming in the venue when we aren't having live music? Let's use this space when it's not being used, and let's kind of get a temperature check of what the community is asking for, what are some of the community needs, especially in the section of Milwaukee and Bayview that Cactus Club inhabits. And that slowly turned into becoming an arts nonprofit, simply because so much of the programming that we started providing was educational based, was art based, was community focused. And we found we should really do this thing. We're about 4 years into our journey, and we're really proud at the data that we've been able to source of how many people have attended free or sliding scale programming, things like book club, things like film screenings, things like harm reduction series. And the community has given us really good feedback.
All right. I'm hoping you can name some names for us. You're in touch with the Milwaukee music scene. Obviously, you're working to lift it up. Who are some of the up-and-coming or maybe newer artists that you have your eye on, even if you don't have your camera on them all the time?
Great question. There's an artist named El Sebas who does Latin hip-hop and R&B. Very, very exciting artist. And his personal work, he overlaps a lot of his work with arts education, bringing artists into after-school programs to teach youth how to get into art and how to create. So I'm really excited to watch El Sebas through 2026. The band Known Moons, who was featured at my book release show at Cactus Club, have just released some new music. So I'm really excited to watch the hopefully national response that they get to their new music. There's a band named Lady Bird who plays alt country rock, and they released a new album this past fall that is amazing. So please check out Lady Bird. And I would say the last one is a new two-piece. I don't know exactly what their genre would be called, but let's say rock. Their name is In Shining Armor, and they're very, very new, very exciting band, unlike something I've seen in a long time in Milwaukee. So I've got my eye very focused on those two.
Samer, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
That's Samer Ghani, an artist and photographer based in Milwaukee. We've been talking about his new photo book. It's called Memories of a Street Cat. Go out with one of Samer's recommendations we just heard there, Milwaukee Latin hip-hop artist El Sebas with the song You.
Se requiere, lo tenemos por adentro. Reporten a la pista, manos arriba. En esta zona los prejuicios no existan. Gracias a la música, tiempo se frisa. Problemas de la mente por un tiempo se olvida. Olvide la bocina, invita a la vecina. Es innegable sentir la energía. Pa' que me invitan, saben cómo me pongo.
Okay, Rob, a question for you. What runs for 54 hours straight in Stevens Point each April?
What is the world's largest trivia contest? And full disclosure, Kate set me up with that answer there. I didn't just know that.
True, true. But the segue here is that the 56th year of this trivia tradition, we're talking with a UW Stevens Point student who's helping to write the 428 questions. And this has been his lifelong dream because his family has been playing in the contest since 1987.
Have you been part of the trivia festivities in Stevens Point? It is a big deal in the area. What is your team name? How do you prepare? What keeps you coming back year after year?
Share your trivia story. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. That number is 888-642-2000. 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Padeswa, Lauren Cox, and Trevor Hook.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.